come back to the question
of
the Four Shores Act.
Yeah.
So you were saying, you know, it's not a narrative in that sense. I mean, yes, the government is so full of official narratives, of like Singapore Official Village, now look at us. But that act
is like completely invisible.
Yes.
They don't want people to know about it.
Yeah, so. Right? And they don't. And so what do you see? Your art is a form of resistance against that totality. So I guess, like, what do you see the act? You said it's invisible.
Yeah.
What else do you see it as?
Okay, we can look into the history of the Four Shores Act. What's really interesting about the Four Shores Act is that it was, you know, usually, you know, there's this very polemic kind of argument. So maybe now you call it the Global South and Europe, you know, and the West. They did all these horrible things to us and all that. And, you know, now you see some, like, you know, with Trump and all that, some fight back, actually. And in a sense, I feel that that argument is becoming more and more generalized. It's quite horrible, actually. I don't think people are just, you can't say a whole bunch of people are just like horrible, like all white people are terrible. And what's interesting in the Four Shores Act is that when you look at it, was that when that law was introduced, it was in 1876. Actually, we went to do some research on it. I don't think it was called the Four Shores Act. It was called like the Ports and Harbors thing. But we need to check on that. Because right now I'm going through the colonial proclamation, actually. And what's interesting with it was that it was actually introduced by the East India Company. Singapore was under the East India Company. And you just imagine, you know, a country, you know, if your law is based on Google coming to your community and setting up a bunch of laws, there we have it, you know. You know, this is our legacy. This is our legacy, actually. And what's really interesting is that when I looked at, in UK, I'm trying to look for the Four Shores Act in UK, they don't have it. I don't think they have it. They have the Crown Lease. It's under the King, the Queen, the King. But I need to look into that more. So it's obviously a colonial thing. And there are several things that are interesting in it. One is called, there's, I think within the sections, there's one part that says that if a community owns land along the coastline of the state can take away that property from that community, actually, before the defense of the state. So what happened was that the British actually had this law, but they didn't really use it to the maximum. But what happened was that when Singapore became independent, and then in the 70s, actually, this is something that a show that I did with Mustafa, actually, at NUS Museum, this show called In Search of Raffles Light, actually, because we were looking through Straits Times newspaper articles, and then we found out that actually it didn't reflect, really, the articles didn't reflect what my experience of the sea was. And then later on, we found out that actually, if you look in the archives of Singapore in the 70s, it was actually very vibrant. There were a lot of people having activities in the sea. There was like sea events. There were like kolek races with communities that were not from Singapore, from the Riau Islands, from like Batam. And hence, the problem actually was Singapore was nation building, and the sea was actually quite porous, in a sense, the relationship was very porous. And what happened was that all these people got moved, through this law actually, got moved into the center of Singapore. And I think there were MPs actually representing islands along the coast. And actually, one of my kampongs, my house, Mataikan was actually. But they didn't really use the Four Shores Act. They just reclaimed it. And then from there, it became disconnected. And then the other law within Four Shores Act, I think it's section 5, is it, or 3. It's called the Proclamation. And I think that is really interesting. What happened is that the president of Singapore actually goes there and then he does a proclamation. But before that, what happens is that it's really interesting. When you do the proclamation, when you do the reclamation, they do reclamation and it drops sand in the sea. Maybe I can show you some videos. This is the, kind of like the first part of the proclamation.
Then the president goes there to the shore and...
No, not really. So what happens is that they're dropping sand in the sea. It's just literally dropping sand in the sea. and then the sand is in the sea. And then there's water. And then at some point in time, there's... The sand actually breaks through the water and then it becomes land. Physically, it's land. You know, as a sailor, if I take a boat, I go there, I see land. You know, I can't go any further. But what's really interesting is that if you look at the charts in Singapore, it says that being reclaimed works in progress. So that land actually legally is not land yet. And this has actually been confirmed with an engineer that I know from Savannah, actually. And what happens is that land is not legally land because the land is too unstable. Because if you build anything on it, things will collapse or move, actually. Roads will actually break apart. And what happened is that on the reclaimed land, there are these machines out there on the east coast of Singapore, they use this machine called CPT, cone penetrative test, or cone penetrative test. And then on the west side, it's by JTC, is another company. They use another process. It's called soil investigation test. And the east side, what happens to the soil investigation test is that they drop this machine in there and they pull out core samples, actually, sand material that they find from the ground, and they bring it to the lab, and then they find, okay, then they assess, like, whether the sand is stable or not, or the land is stable or not. On the other side, actually, the lab is actually on the land. Both instances, when I've encountered these people, they're actually from Myanmar. These geologists, they're from Myanmar. Because what happened was that when Singapore became independent, we had the NUS department had a geology lab. And our ministers actually thought that Singapore, we're not into coal mining, we're not into... Why should we have a geology lab? So they actually shrunk the geology lab. So we don't have enough geologists in Singapore. So what happened was that we started getting a lot of geologists from Myanmar, actually, and from outside Singapore. So mainly, like, these people are from there. But now, recently, actually, NUS has increased. They realized this. So they have increased their geology lab, actually. So what happens is that you have these machines out there, and these people are measuring the solidity of sand. And this is something I'm particularly interested in. Measuring. And I think it takes something like, in the past, it was like 4 years. And then now they have dropped it, you know, like something like 2 years, because they have all these new methods of making the sand compress faster, actually, like putting pipes in the water, in the sand or plastic. And what happens is that data is collected and is given to a certain department within HDB, the departments that are doing the reclamation, the HDB, military, or JTC. And I'm not too sure what this part is, because I tried contacting the people that are doing this. In JTC, I think there's a department called the Land Reclamation Design Unit, actually. And I think there's only like four or three people inside.